Today is Monday, June 7th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Vice President Kamala Harris in Guatemala over migration issues.
On her first foreign trip as Vice President, Kamala Harris will speak to officials and nonprofit leaders in Guatemala and Mexico.
Plus, Burkina Faso mourns 160 victims killed by terrorists.
The attack happened overnight Friday at the village of Solhan, located in the Yarga province in the country's Sahel region.
Also, UN marks World Food Safety Day. Our top story today is in Pakistan. A rescue operation is underway in Pakistan after a train smashed into derailed carriages from another train on Monday, killing at least 40 people, government officials said, in the latest accident to highlight the perilous state of a more than 165-year-old railway system. The accident in Ghotki district of southern Sindh province occurred after the coaches of one train, the Melat Express, derailed and fell across the opposite track, where they were hit by another train, the Sir Said Express, a spokesman for Pakistan's railway, said in a statement. The death toll was likely to rise as rescuers struggled to reach people trapped in several mangled compartments. Military helicopters arrived at the scene to ferry the injured to the nearest hospital. Police officer Umar Tufai put the current death toll at 40, including four bodies stuck in the wreckage. The government in Burkina Faso has declared 3 days of mourning following an attack that left at least 160 people dead late last week in the northern village of Solhan. Henry Wilkins reports on the aftermath.
Laurent Sorge, the head of the Burkina Faso delegation of the International Committee for the Red Cross, said the organization responded Sunday morning to a request for medical supplies, noting local hospitals are overwhelmed.
Upon request for support by the health authorities in Dori, we sent half a ton of medical support, mainly dressing, medicaments, sets of plasters, syringes, and anesthetic, which was really important to be sent with no delay.
Dori is a town in northern Burkina Faso. The attack happened overnight Friday at the village of Solhan, located in the Yarga province in the country's Sahel region. The extent of the carnage is not known because the number of dead and injured continues to rise. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, although analysts say it could be the work of Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. The attack is the deadliest since the conflict between Burkina Faso and armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group began in 2015. The violence follows a period of relative calm. Between March 2020 and April 2021, the number of attacks in Burkina Faso fell dramatically. Since the beginning of April, seven major attacks have come in quick succession. On May 17th, Burkina Faso's foreign minister, Sheriff Sy, visited Sabah, the nearest town to Solhan. He said the situation in Sabah was favourable and that peace had returned to the area. Mahamadou Sawadogo is a Burkinabe security analyst and former military police officer. Sawadogo said one could see this attack as a show of force, a demonstration of power by terrorist armed groups. He said that today they have shown they control the province of Yarga, and particularly the area of Solhan that they have been trying to conquer since 2020. Solhan is also the site of an informal gold mine that terror groups frequently exploit for funding. The military in Burkina Faso is under-resourced and is finding it impossible to provide security in all regions of the country, despite assistance from French and US troops. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
The Islamic State West African Province, or ISWAP, militant group said in an audio recorded heard by Reuters on Sunday that Abubakar Shekau, leader of rival Nigerian militant Islamist group Boko Haram, was dead. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
The leader of Nigerian Islamist militant group Boko Haram is dead, a rival militant group said in an audio recording heard by Reuters on Sunday. The leader of the Islamic State West African province reportedly said that Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau killed himself with explosives last month after a battle between the two groups.
Shekau preferred to be humiliated in the afterlife than get humiliated on earth, and he killed himself instantly by detonating an explosive.
Boko Haram's leader has been reported killed on several occasions over the last 12 years. But two sources familiar with the matter confirmed the news came from ISWAP leader himself, Abu Musab al-Barnawi. It's also been confirmed by a Nigerian intelligence report shared by a government official and Boko Haram researchers. Political analysts say Shekau's death could lead to the end of a violent rivalry between the two groups, enabling ISWAP to lure over Boko Haram fighters and consolidate its hold on northeastern Nigeria. ISWAP was previously part of Boko Haram before it split off 5 years ago after it objected to Boko Haram's killing of civilians. In 2014, Boko Haram grabbed headlines worldwide after kidnapping more than 270 schoolgirls from the town of Chibok, sparking a global campaign for their return. Around 100 of the Chibok girls are still missing, and some are thought to have died in captivity. Boko Haram has killed more than 30,000 people, forced around 2 million people to flee their homes, and spawned one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Guatemala and later Mexico this week on a trip that spotlights migration issues at the southern U.S. border. Michelle Quinn reports.
On her first foreign trip as vice president, Kamala Harris will speak to officials and nonprofit leaders in Guatemala and Mexico about deep-seated problems such as poverty and violence, which migrant rights advocates say are the main reasons Central Americans and others leave their homes for the United States. The trip comes after the Biden administration formally ended a policy requiring asylum seekers to wait in Mexico, a policy established by then-President Donald Trump in 2019. The policy saw the return of nearly 70,000 people to Mexico in the 2 years it was in effect. Public attention on the U.S. southern border has waned in recent weeks as the number of unaccompanied minors held by the Border Patrol fell from about 5,700 children in the last week of March to 677 in early May. Still, people keep trying to cross. U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported that in April, it encountered about 180,000 people, a 3% increase over March 2021. In an NPR Ipsos poll in May, 4 out of 5 Americans identified the border issue as a problem. Some policymakers say that along with border enforcement, it is important to look at the conditions that push people in the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to travel north.
We are addressing the root causes of migration from the Northern Triangle countries, addressing the reasons why families send their children in the first place.
Republicans have criticized the Biden administration for its border policies, particularly the unwinding of some Trump-era efforts. Congressman Steve Scalise spoke in April.
Vice President Harris needs to go down to the border and see this for herself, because maybe she would then encourage President Biden to reverse his policies that have failed.
Harris is meeting Guatemala officials and nonprofit leaders on Monday. On Tuesday, she heads to Mexico City to meet with government officials. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Democrats are struggling to fulfill campaign promises 6 months into their hold on Washington. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
As Democrats strain to deliver on President Biden's agenda, the limits of bipartisanship in the 50-50 Senate are increasingly clear. Talks over an infrastructure package are teetering. Biden is set to meet today with the lead Republican negotiator, and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin is optimistic.
The president has gone from 2.25 trillion down to $1 trillion. The Republicans have come up.
Meanwhile, a voting and elections overhaul bill is essentially dead now that Manchin announced his opposition.
If we continue to divide it and separate us more, it's not going to be united, and it's not going to be the country that we love and know.
Manchin made the comments on Fox News Sunday. I'm Julie Walker.
For more than 6 months, fighting has engulfed Ethiopia's Tigray region. The United Nations warns of imminent famine, and there appears to be no end in sight for the conflict. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdock is traveling in the region, and International Edition Steve Miller caught up with her in the regional capital of Mekelle after she traveled to Adigrat.
what happened yesterday when we arrived in early afternoon. The Iraqi people told us the story that there was an Eritrean soldier in the market, and the local people, in their anger, started throwing rocks and killed the soldier. And then other Eritrean soldiers, as many as 100 or 200, came to the market to retrieve the body of the soldier and were threatening local people with revenge for the death of their soldier. This is a great example of how people feel in this town. There's a lot of anger, a lot of mistrust. And when local people told that story, you could see them almost not even be able to speak. They were so angry, not about the fact that there are, about the Eritrean presence in their city. There was also skirmishes in the area recently, and it's quite tense and very near to a serious battle zone. We also traveled to Housing today, which is one of the worst hit towns in this area. It's been taken over by various forces. I think about four or five times it's switched hands since last November.
Heather, did they say where their anger is directed? Because this is a war that is being carried out between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Ethiopian and Eritrean forces, and all sides in the conflict have been accused of committing human rights abuses.
A lot of the anger is directed at the Ethiopian government forces and specifically the Eritrean forces. But one of the points of contention with the Ethiopian government forces, or at least the Ethiopian government, is that it allows Eritrean forces to be in their country. They see the Eritrean forces as threatening, and there's lots of stories of abuses. And while the stories about the Ethiopian government forces, there's also terrible stories about them, and as well as every other group involved in this battle. But on the ground, what we hear every day is anger directed towards the Eritrean forces and blaming the Ethiopian forces for allowing them to be there.
The Israeli prime minister railed against a proposed coalition government to unseat him in a day after the nation's domestic security chief warned of the threat of political violence. Zachary Goldman of Reuters reports.
On the verge of losing his record-long grip on power, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday lashed out at his perceived political opponents.
We are witnessing the greatest election fraud in the history of the country. In my opinion, in the history of any democracy.
His language reminiscent of another world leader who recently faced the prospect of losing power.
We had an election that was stolen from us.
It mirrors the rhetoric of former U.S. President Donald Trump, who falsely claims that his 2020 election defeat was the result of fraud.
This was a fraudulent election.
Those claims sparked a deadly assault by Trump supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol to try to stop Congress from certifying his election loss. And now fears of political violence are bubbling up in Israel. Netanyahu's claims of fraud come just a day after Israel's chief of domestic security issued a rare warning of possible political violence in that country. Shin Bet director Nadav Argamon called on political and religious leaders to tone down potential incitement. Netanyahu is facing the prospect of an end to his 12-year run as premier after Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid announced last week that he had succeeded in forming a governing coalition. The centrist cobbled together an unwieldy array of factions stretching from ultranationalist to leftist and even, for the first time in Israel's history, an Arab Islamist party. But Lapid's proposed government has yet to be sworn in and could still unravel before it begins. It will require a simple majority vote in the 120-member Knesset, but that could be more than a week away. Netanyahu has been whipping up outrage at the man expected to replace him as prime minister, Naftali Bennett. Bennett leads an ultra-nationalist party, and he broke his campaign pledge not to join a coalition with Lapid and left-wing and Arab parties. Netanyahu called on Bennett's party members to reject what he's called, quote, a dangerous leftist government.
That's Zachary Coleman of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. A Shiite cleric who, as Iran's ambassador to Syria, helped found the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah and lost his right hand to a book bombing reportedly carried out by Israel, has died. He was 74. Iranian state media says Ali Akbar Mohad Shamipour died in a northern Tehran hospital after contracting the coronavirus. He was a close ally of Iran's late supreme leader, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Russian officials and lawmakers have denounced the design of the Ukrainian national soccer team's shirt for this month's European Championship. The yellow and blue Ukrainian uniform features a map of the country that includes Crimea. The Black Sea Peninsula was annexed by Russia in 2014, following the ouster of its Moscow-friendly president. Most of the world hasn't acknowledged the annexation. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Today is World Food Safety Day, and UN agencies are calling for concerted action to ensure food is free of the toxins that every year cause the death of hundreds of thousands of people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A UN report on global food security finds nearly 690 million people suffered from chronic hunger in 2019, before COVID-19. The full impact of the pandemic on food insecurity is not yet known. However, the report estimates as many as 132 million more people will have been short of food in 2020 because of COVID-19 lockdowns. Dominique Bourgeon is director of the Food and Agriculture Organization office in Geneva. He says food safety is key to food security.
Every year, 600 million people fall ill, one in 10. About, and 420,000 die from eating food contaminated with bacteria, viruses, parasites, toxins, or chemicals. Yet, this is the tip of the iceberg, as comprehensive surveillance data for foodborne illnesses is not available everywhere.
Moreover, he says unsafe food causes significant financial burdens in low and middle income countries, amounting to productivity losses of some $90 billion a year. UN agencies say food safety is a shared responsibility and everyone has a role to play in keeping food safe and keeping people healthy. Bourgeon says this includes those who produce the food, industry, governments, and consumers.
The way you store your food, the way you cook it, but of course it goes, I would say, from farm to fork, so really at the beginning of the process, the way food is being produced, the type of way the food is stored, and then the way it's transported, processed, etc.
UN agencies say food safety involves a holistic approach that considers human, animal, plant, and environmental health. Understanding and keeping all aspects of the food chain safe, they say, will contribute to a healthy life and a healthy planet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Australia's Victoria state are scrambling to track the source of a highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus as new cases rise among the population. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Authorities reported 11 new cases, some of which were the highly infectious Delta variant, likely the cause of India's latest devastating outbreak. Officials added all cases were linked to existing clusters. Meanwhile, residents in the state's capital city, Melbourne, wait for the latest lockdown to lift, scheduled for Thursday night. But Victoria's top health official, Brett Sutton, said plans could change.
As I've always said, we're looking at numbers every day. We make those decisions on a day-by-day basis. I don't know what today will bring in terms of new notified cases.
Melbourne on Monday entered its 11th day of a hard lockdown after officials over the weekend found the Delta virus variant. Australia has largely contained outbreaks with snap lockdowns, regional border restrictions, and social distancing measures. And nearly 20% of the country's adult population has received a first dose of a vaccine.
Still in Australia, the nation's most decorated Afghan veteran will deny alleged war crimes Monday at the start of his high-stakes defamation trial against one of the country's biggest media companies. Ben Robert Smith will seek to prove he was unfairly portrayed in newspaper stories as having broken the moral and legal rules of war. He's seeking damages in Australia's federal court from 9 entertainment companies and 3 journalists. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Newspaper reports in 2018 alleged Ben Robert Smith murdered a man in Afghanistan and encouraged his colleagues to drink beer from his victim's prosthetic leg. He was also accused of killing an unarmed Afghan shepherd by kicking him off a cliff and ordering his fellow soldiers to shoot him. The former Special Air Service Regiment trooper, who received the Victoria Cross, Australia's highest military honour, in 2011, has denied any wrongdoing. He said articles published by The Age, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Canberra Times newspapers portrayed him as a war criminal who disgraced his country by murdering Afghan civilians. Robert Smith said the stories were baseless and flawed. His lawyer told the hearing Monday that he was an exceptional soldier, but was the victim of dishonest journalism and corrosive jealousy and lies. The trial in Sydney is expected to hear from about 60 witnesses over the next 10 weeks. Current and former members of Australia's Special Forces are scheduled to give evidence anonymously. Other witnesses will testify via a video link from a law firm in Kabul. Associate Professor Ben Wadham, a military historian from Flinders University, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the case goes to the heart of Australia's conduct during times of conflict.
It has brought into tension that question about, does everything and anything go in war, or do we actually have some responsibility to these higher values, and shouldn't we be upholding them?
Last November, a landmark inquiry into Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan found credible evidence of the murder of 39 prisoners, farmers or other civilians. A lengthy investigation examined claims of unlawful killings and other possible breaches by Australia's elite Special Forces in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016. Ben Robert Smith left the army in 2013 and is currently the general manager of the Seven Network, a media company in Brisbane and regional Queensland. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Pope Francis said on Sunday that he was pained by the discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada, but he stopped short of the apology some Canadians are demanding. Lucy Fielder of Reuters reports.
Pope Francis said on Sunday that he was pained by the discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada and called for the respect of the rights and cultures of native peoples. But during his weekly blessing at St. Peter's Square, Francis stopped short of the direct apology some Canadians had demanded. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said this week the Catholic Church must take responsibility for its role in running many of the schools. Francis urged Canadian political and Catholic religious leaders to cooperate with determination, to shed light on the finding and to seek reconciliation and healing. And he prayed for Canada's Indigenous families. The residential schools operated between 1831 and 1996 and were run on behalf of the government, mostly by the Catholic Church. The schools forcibly separated about 150,000 children from their homes. Many were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition in what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2015 called cultural genocide. The discovery last month of the remains of the children at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, which closed in 1978, has reopened wounds for survivors of the system. Francis has in the past apologized for the church's role in colonialism in the Americas, but he has mostly chosen to make direct apologies while visiting countries and talking to native peoples. And no papal visit to Canada is scheduled.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. The oldest male chimpanzee living in an accredited North American zoo died Saturday at the San Francisco Zoo and Gardens. He was 63. The chimpanzee named Kobe had been a hand-reared performing chimpanzee before he was brought to the San Francisco Zoo in the 1960s. Although the chimpanzee's cause of death had not been determined, the animal had recently been ill and zoo officials believe old age was a factor. The zoo says the average life expectancy of chimpanzees living in the wild is 33 years, while it's between 50 and 60 years under human care. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.